Hello and welcome back. No whistle to be recording on, but still a Sunday podcast. Well, there's a few whistles in the FA Cup, but not your traditional on the whistle Sunday podcast. This is Relatively Football. I am Theo Lloyd-Hughes, and I'm here with two people on Zoom. Could call them both family. We're all family, but one of them does have the same blood in my veins as me. And that is my sister, Flo. How's it going, Flo?
Yeah, I'm not bad. Not bad, thanks.
Save the rest of that chat for the Relatively Blood podcast.
Yeah. Relatively Science, out soon. Yeah. Another sub-brand to be had.
Always good to get that out. And yeah, as I alluded to, part of the extended family, you know, the family is growing. Relatively Football podcast. We're getting Sibs connected, but also non-Sibs are becoming Sibs. So honoured to have the brilliant mind that is Jessie Parker Humphreys on the podcast. Hello, Jessie.
Hello. Thrilled to be a honorary Lloyd Hughes for the evening.
We've always got to get extra guests when there's so many games that Theo and I can't quite get the energy to watch all of them. So I'm glad you could be of assistance. Yeah, literally.
It's part, you know, love and appreciation and part ploy. I think when we got six WSL games and, you know, one or two championship that we can get our eyes on, we feel quite qualified. And then the minute we're at whatever it was this weekend, 15 games or whatever, you start to feel quite quite powerless. So we need
and
your power.
And when you've
Jessie,
been, you were on the road to Houston, I was covering a game Friday night and Saturday afternoon. It's a tricky one, but you know. Although I did have the France England game on my phone when I was at Watford on Friday night, and it was tricky to say the least. So I did have to watch some of that game back today. But relative logistics, get into opening night in the NWSL.
We're gonna start there.
Well,
okay.
Why don't you just give us some logistics chat just to like warm us up a little bit?
Felt really safe. There was 4,200 people there, which is more than the average attendance for the last Dash season with fans.
That's good.
Yeah, the stadium's built for about 2022, so yeah, you're still at 20% capacity, which I think felt really safe. There was loads of the whole stadium was open. It wasn't like I haven't really been to too many games within this kind of period, but I feel like the way they spread everyone out was really good. Didn't feel like there was any crowding. It felt like there was always like four or five seats between
That's
groups
good.
Of two or four. Temperature checks,
love it.
Tick. You had to fill out a little survey.
Classic.
I didn't know they were still doing that. You had to fill out a survey, being like, "Who have you been with? What are you into?
Who you been hanging
what's
out
your,
with?
What's your star sign?
Wishes, hopes, and dreams."
Yeah, so it was kind of, a little bit groovy. I always appreciate a survey on who I've been hanging out with before I enter a football stadium. Good food in the press box.
Nice.
Although there is kind of this weird thing where, like, last time I was in the press box, there was no food or drink because it was, like, deep, deep COVID. Now they've added food or drink, but everyone's a bit embarrassed to take off their mask.
Oh. But what was the food and drink? Was it worth taking off your mask for?
It was fried chicken and chips.
Wow.
For free?
Faux free.
Wow.
Yes.
That is good. That is really good. I would have taken my mask off for that's for sure.
I kept my mask on. I was there with a colleague and we were meeting each other for the first time.
No so. Veggie options, because I think you're a sort of semi full-time veggie. So that's a tricky
exactly.
one. No veggie options.
So hence why I was not.
But you are in Texas, so that's a tricky one. But
yeah, so I guess maybe on the next survey I'll talk about veggie options.
Yeah, feedback.
Jessie, any questions about the logistics before we move on to some football?
No, I mean, that fried chicken sounds amazing, though. It puts Chelsea's pot noodle options to shame, really.
So I'm going to read out some results because we've got quite a lot of games to get to. And by all means, there are internationals I'm not going to read off, listener. And then, if you just want to jump in, Flo, Jessie, myself, and we'll kind of see where we go. So the internationals woke up on Friday with Wales losing at home 3-0 to Canada. Really amazing Jess Fleming goal and a really brilliant assist from Quinn. Was sort of the highlights in that one. Spain beat Holland 1-0, which got the whole women's football mafia talking on Twitter about how brilliant Spain are, which we kind of saw glimpses of the last couple of years, especially at She Believes in 2020. And obviously Spain aren't going to be at the Olympics, so they're kind of the sleeping giant who we're not going to get too much more exposure of. Then France beat England 3-1 on Friday night. We'll get into that in a moment. Germany smashed Australia 5-2. Sweden drew with the USA. And then in qualifiers, Ukraine lost at home to Northern Ireland. Rachel Furnish and Simone McGill scoring off the bat very early, and then McGill getting the second, which would be the winner, two away goals there for Northern Ireland. They got a second leg to come, qualifying for next year's summer tournament. Portugal lost at home 1-0 to Russia. And this is, for me, if you're going to watch any second leg, listener, I would try and seek out Czech Republic versus Switzerland. It was 1-1 in the first leg. West Ham's Fitkova scoring from the penalty spot at the beginning of the second half, and then right at the death in the 92nd minute, Anna Maria, apologies for the pronunciation, Kernan-Govovic scored the equaliser from the penalty spot. If you do recognise the name, probably pronounced much better than I, she does play for Barcelona and has appeared in the Champions League a couple of times this year, kind of off the bench. She's not necessarily a starting player.
Alex, please send us a voice note if you're listening of how to pronounce her name. We would appreciate it.
Apologies. And she used to play for the Portland Thorns. So American fans out there who are going, Anna Marie, she sounds familiar. Yeah, she used to play for the Portland Thorns, defender, midfielder, kind of. I think she's played in a few different positions. But yeah, obviously an experienced player for Swiss, and she steps up, scores that last minute penalty. Big away goal there in that second leg in Switzerland will be really exciting. So Flo, Jesse, where do you want to start?
Should we start with England? As that's probably the closest to home in some ways, although it took place in France. I mean, Jesse and I were chatting during the game. Theo, I don't know how much of it you've watched, because obviously you were in Houston, like driving or hanging out in the city, eating fried chicken, doing something.
I arrived at halftime in the city of Houston, so I caught the second half.
I think,
and I watched the highlights back.
I guess let's start from before kickoff. The setup, the formation, and the starting lineup were a little bit baffling, to say the least. I think more generally, I'm surprised at how these games are still being treated too much like a trial and error sort of exploration training match. Let's kind of throw shit at the wall and see what sticks, kind of thing. Jesse, I know you have thoughts on the formation and the starting lineup as well, and we were both not keen on how Risa set the team up, basically.
Yeah, I mean, I think these kind of games can be tricky, especially for Risa coming in. You know, she obviously wants to see these players play in competitive situations, but at the same time, you probably don't want to happen what did happen, which is kind of be roundly embarrassed by a very good side. It was a bit of a strange one because Risa is quite well known for playing like these attacking, exciting 4-3-3 formations. And obviously that's kind of a formation that England are very familiar with. But instead we went with this kind of like quite flat feeling 4-4-2, where these like huge gaps were just opening up between defence and midfield a lot of the time. You had Beth Mead playing on the left wing, which was odd as well, because you can kind of see her as an inside forward on the left being able to cut in on the right. But in a 4-4-2, she kind of needed to have that ability to go down the line, which she just couldn't do because she's right-footed. And you saw how effective that was when Lauren Hemp finally did come on and she's left-footed. So you can see how that formation could work. But again, I didn't really understand what she wanted from Beth Mead there. I didn't really understand what relationship she expected Fran Kirby and Ellen White to have as well. Because Kirby looked good when she dropped back at points, but again, it just all felt like kind of like what you just said, like throwing stuff at a wall and trying to figure it out.
Bit too experimental.
Do you think Risa would have just seen this as a way to experiment with that flat formation you saw and at least know that that's not the right formation moving forward? Do you think that's valuable?
I do think it's valuable, and I think it's something she had to do because, you know, she's only had that game against Northern Ireland. That was always going to be a totally different ballpark to these kind of level of fixtures. I think the most concerning thing for England to take away from that game is the defence. But I think this is also what like disappointed me, because you can look at that defence and say, well, it was really makeshift, because it was. And there were lots of players playing out position who you would in normal circumstances not expect to necessarily be playing that way. But I think what was so disappointing was that there were players on the bench who I thought of should have been given opportunities and chances. If you're going to play an experimental back line, don't play Rachel Daly at right back and then at left back. Like, go with Neve Charles, try Esme Morgan. You know, you've brought these younger players into the team. Like, that's the experiment you should be making. We've tried the Rachel Daly experiment a million times and it's always rubbish.
I also just think, I think it's frustrating. I just think it's frustrating as well from that sense, is that actually when you look at the squad she called up, you could quite easily pick a best 11 based on the formation she wanted to play and figure it out. But she didn't do that, which is why I'm a little bit baffled, because she almost went for players that were completely the opposite of that position and then thought it might work out. Whereas, you know, she's not been blindly led into this job. She's a brilliant coach and she's had like tons of dossiers, watched plenty of footage of this team and worked with them a little bit now already. So she does know a fair bit about how to work with them and how to get the best out of them. And I was just a bit confused. And I don't think it's necessarily her fault, because she's been put in a rubbish position. The FA have kind of set up this team to fail in many a way, and they haven't been given enough time to have any good chance of doing well at the Olympics. And Risa has had hardly any time to get used to playing with them. So I don't really necessarily like blame the group or her that much, but I just am a little bit confused when you're given such a good opportunity to put out a quite strong team, you don't do that, and then are surprised when you kind of fail quite considerably. And like we said, those gaps that opened up were just huge. I mean, any time France turned over the ball, they had about 30 yards to choose from where there was no England players around them, and the defence were either getting dragged forward or dragged deep and having France be able to just run at them. It was just kind of, yeah, messy to watch. And you, I was almost like watching it behind my eyes, like, what are you doing? Like, what is going on? Whereas I suppose with Neville, there was a bit of boring stability, at least, because he rarely tried new things.
Whereas, well, he did try Daly at fullback, though, kind of like Jess was saying. We have been there and done
that.
Yeah, but
that was the only ever sort of risk, I guess, is that he took. And that was only ever if Bronze was injured or it was a weaker game where he didn't feel like he needed her. But this just felt far too, like, wacky.
But actually, in terms of, I think that's what was disappointing, though, in terms of formation, this wasn't a departure from Neville. You know, if you take out the fact that Kirby obviously didn't play because of, you know, various injuries, she didn't feature that prominently in the World Cup, then obviously she had pericarditis, so she wasn't in kind of Neville's end plans. But otherwise, you basically got a perfect Neville team. Okay, but maybe Beth Mead doesn't feature as much too, but I think that's what was problematic for me. But I do think it's important to say that they were playing against what is probably one of the best, like, I know they were basically playing as a four because they had Valerie Gauvin, but in Diani, Sandy Baltimore, Marie-Antoinette Kodoto, they were playing against a set of players who I think are probably
quite terrifying,
the best front three in France, if not in Europe, you know. And I think what we saw across like lots of these fixtures in this international break is the teams that are really excelling are teams which are playing together a lot domestically because of the breaks international teams had. And that's three players who play together week in, week out. But again, that was what was annoying at England, because you could have done that and played Kemp, White and Kelly.
Yeah.
Well, I think that something I wrote on my notes when I was watching the second half, and even...
What are you, me? Only watching second halves
yeah,
now? That's
I did
my
a flow.
Thing.
I only watched second half. But especially when Marie-Antoinette scored, and even when Daly gave away the penalty for France's second goal. I missed Sandy Baltimore's first goal, but saw the highlights on Twitter. I mean, we just need
that
to
was
have
a great goal.
Silence.
That was, you
so
know,
what
that was a great goal.
Stonking
she
finish.
Is some
just
player.
So good to see. And so good to see only on a fifth cap, like, just looks like she's ready for the world stage. But I guess what I was going to say was something I wrote in my notes second half is I was like, this reminded me a little bit of, I mean, Fran gets a late penalty to make it 3-1, but it reminded me of the Man City Barcelona game, where we watch a lot of WSL, we watch a lot of these England players, we see them on ads, we see the league getting a lot of exposure, and then they come up against opposition that maybe we haven't watched as much, and you're like, as you said, Jesse, is this the best front three in European football right now, or domestic? And it's a bit of a reality check.
I personally am not one of those people who, like, in reality thinks that England are the best team in the world, because they're clearly not. So I don't ever want to channel that sort of arrogance of like, how are we losing to France? We're the best team in the world, blah, 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 blah. But I just think there is a difference between what Man City did, which was just set up in a naive way, but play a good starting 11 of players. They didn't exactly put out a weakened side, but Gareth Taylor didn't set up his team well and looked like he hadn't done his homework. It almost felt like the same thing with Hege Riise as well. Like, she set up her team to fail on Friday night, and that's what's frustrating, I think, because they probably might have lost anyway, who knows, but at least it wouldn't have been as kind of disappointing of a watch, because I think there is a massive issue with English football in general at all levels across men's and women's of hype, and we fall for it all the time, and you know, it's the hope that kills us, all this kind of stuff, and it doesn't help as the game grows, the hype grows, and you know, with every single England camp there's so much content and we all love it and it's great and everyone gets really excited to watch the games, and then you know, it's inevitable that you're going to be disappointed, because the reality check is, like you said, they're not the best team in the world. But it does concern me for the Euros, because I think that's such a huge moment, and it's just frustrating about what might happen to England at that home tournament.
I think what's concerning is defensively, because I don't want to go to Mr. XG, because I know it gives Flo hives or whatever, but England...
I'm listening, Jesse. You got my ear.
I checked the XG before this, and England created 2.5 XG. And you can see it, like, when they're attacking, you know, Kira Walsh hits the post, Nikita Paris misses a header at the end of the first half, which she should really have scored. So they were creating chances, and I think when you look at the players coming through for England, you know that attacking, all the exciting players are attacking players, right? You've got Hemp and Kelly in the setup at the moment, then you've got Salmon, James, you know, all these other players who are kind of teenagers coming through. Whereas defensively, I think what the worry is you've got people aging out, you know, Greenwood, Stokes, Bronze, your fullbacks, basically. You don't necessarily feel like you've got the same, like, quality level of players coming through. Like,
Greenwood was pretty desperate on Friday for everything.
They looked slow. The whole defence looked slow. And that's why it was, you know...
Which is so reminiscent of Phil Neville's teams. I always think they look slow.
Right. But, like, lots of these players are, like, they're in their late 20s, you know? And even when you've got, like, okay, Esme Morgan got absolutely beasted against Barcelona. She could be a good player, but she's clearly not there yet. Neve Charles, equally, might be an amazing fullback, but she's played in the role, like, four times for Chelsea.
Lottie Webber-Moyes is the future, and she must be captain of England now.
Webber-Moyes is a good shout, because Brighton, Williamson, a lot of people have been asking for that, and it didn't really work. I think we obviously need to give them more than one game.
Gemma Bonner, Lottie Webber-Moyes duo.
Oh, God.
The Neve Charles, hashtag free Bonner.
Hashtag free Bonner.
The Neve Charles thing is interesting, though, because the other, like, English trope is Neve Charles has, like, four of the best games I've ever seen at right back ever in her first.
Yeah,
like,
and now she has to play there forever.
And now I'm like, I'm pretty sure Neve Charles is ready for the Ballon d'Or. We've got a wonder kid. I've literally, like, Neve Charles has played the best four games I've ever seen anyone play at right back. And if we're not winning the World Cup with Neve Charles, then I don't know what we're doing.
The hype is unreal.
It's because Emma Hayes has crowned her. Emma Hayes said, I'm moulding Neve Charles to play right back for England. So there we go. We're like, if Emma says it.
I think it's a perfect segue as well to move on to the USA game, because there's so many similarities here in the sense of kind of a reality check and a wake-up call to European women's football and how you may not be the kings anymore. I only caught up with this game watching the highlights. Jesse, I know you watched the full 90. Theo, did you watch the full 90?
I watched the full 90.
Jesse and I really enjoyed the Twitter meltdown of a lot of WOSO stands on USA going a goal down and how that unraveled on the timeline. And it was quite funny to kind of witness people freaking out about the fact that the US were losing to Sweden.
I think what was so funny was the way it wasn't like people just freaking out. It was, say, everyone going... They were like the personification of, you know, the meme where the dog's like in the fire going, this is fine. Like, that's what everyone was like. They were like, it's great that we've got a goal down because it's really important to learn from these kind of games. And you just knew they were sat there like laptops crying as they typed it.
But what I was going to say about this on the kind of going behind thing is I think maybe this is getting a little bit too spicy, but it's almost a little bit S&M-y. Like, I think
it's punishing.
The US fans almost wanted a little bit of pain because it comes with a little bit of extra pleasure.
But is Rapido getting a jammy penalty, well, scoring a jammy penalty, pleasurable?
I think the novelty of the US coming from behind to snatch a draw is so overdue. I'm really serious. If you win whatever it was, 18 games in a row, the joy from the sport starts to go. I really mean that. And so I honestly think some US fans, in the same way you're like, you know, it's like eating your vegetables, they're like, we've got to learn how to come from a goal behind. This is, maybe if they'd won it, it would have felt even better. But I honestly think it's actually quite a good result because you get to experience something different. And we watch the game for not knowing what's going to happen. So for the USA to go against arguably the third best team in the world, they had the bronze at the World Cup. This is, you know, not a terrible result away to Sweden.
But they didn't and play very well. I think it'd be different if you have an incredible comeback, come from a goal behind and play really well. And, you know, it was almost like you had to fight against this huge challenge. I just thought they played really badly.
I guess I think what would concern me if I was a US fan was that it felt to me like a lot of the issues in this game kind of were similar to in that Canada game against in the She Believes Cup. And I know the US eventually went on to win that, but Canada had so many opportunities to go ahead in that game and just didn't take them.
Becky basically missed a tap-in, didn't she, at one point?
Right. And like Sweden equally should have scored like two or three before the US got its penalty. And I think I totally agree with what you're saying, Theo, because, you know, I support a team who often play very well. Like, sometimes I get that. But I think what would maybe be the voice in the back of my head would be like, oh, like, this isn't necessarily just a one-off.
If it keeps happening, which I think that's the thing. I think they look quite stale. And I would be intrigued to see what awaits in the next game, which could be a big wake-up call to France, for sure. Lots of people are excited about that game. I think it's going to be a brilliant matchup. But, you know, if they lose that game, the timeline will be popping off.
Corinne Diacre will be so powerful.
The Cruella de Vil will be basically wearing the skin of the US players.
That's what will be funny as well, is because so many people in France hate Corinne Diacre being manager of France, but then she could come out with these two wins against England
against
and
the old
US
foes. Yeah.
Oh my god. International break, we love it.
It was quite slow tempo as well. They never almost they turned the gas up. So Press would almost like get to the byline, do that thing where she like looks to cut in and then just put in a bit of a crap cross. Whereas actually if you'd stepped it up a notch, by the time you put in a ball, Sweden would have been playing catch up and you probably would have got a better chance than you did. So yeah, it just felt like everyone was two steps behind. Yes, 39 is it, Carly Lloyd now? Getting her 300th cap probably was more ceremonial than anything. Whether she's good enough to be playing in that position, probably not. But yeah, I'm excited for that France game. It's going to be a good one.
Any other things you're dying to say about any other internationals? I really love Quinn's assist for Deanne Rose's goal. Was fantastic. There's a great angle of it on their Twitter. You kind of see it from Deanne Rose's point of view. I think it's filmed on a phone, like at pitch level. Really amazing assist. And Quinn was so good in the She Believes Cup as well. So excited to see.
Jesse, do you want to quickly talk about your witnessing of Australia get torn apart by Germany?
Yeah, you could really tell in this game that Australia hadn't played together for, I think it was like over 400 days. And they've got a totally new coach. But Germany were really good. I'm obsessed with Eula Brandt, who came on for her debut for Germany and got a goal and assist within about 10 minutes and looked really, really good. She's 18. She plays for Hoffenheim. I particularly liked it because I was listening to the German commentary, and when she scored, they called her Kula Eula, which I just thought was great.
Cool. That was fun. Get that trending.
Yeah, exactly.
Hashtag Kula Eula.
But yeah, she looked really good. Again, I think Germany just really benefit from having quite a lot of Bayern players in that team, and that they actually there was a lot of talk about France playing a weakened team, but I actually thought France missing the Lyon players wasn't necessarily a bad thing. But in this case, Germany were missing a lot of Wolfsburg players because they've had a COVID outbreak, and there were a number of close contacts who were ruled out that game, so like Lena Oberdorf being like an obvious example. But Germany still looked really, really good, and I think watching games across, you know, this weekend, for me, Germany and Spain, both of them just feel like a level above at the moment. So
what do you think makes this Spain team so good? Continuity, the manager, the tactics, the sheer quality of the players?
Again, I think it's that everyone plays for Barcelona. Like, I just think at the moment
England,
like,
need to become Man City FC, basically.
Well, they have that.
they have. I mean,
the players,
you could
do
that.
It.
You could switch that button. Yeah.
But yeah, they were like so good. Alexia Putellas basically ran the whole show. Like, the Netherlands just could not get near them. Spain should have scored like several more goals. there were some like absolutely like mouth-watering like moments of skill from Spain. And yeah, I think that would be the only worry, is that they only scored one. Especially when we've seen, you know, France and Germany like score a load. But you know, Holland are a tough side to beat. They were probably of all of those teams that Spain was the hardest matchup. But yeah, they were really, really good. And I don't know, maybe it's a bit of a worry for Holland because they've obviously got this, you know, Serena Wiegmann leaving. It's always a bit strange when you've got like lame duck managers. But the whole point was that she was going to stay for the Olympics. But they just feel a bit stodgy. Definitely in this game. She started Jill Roord over Bierenstein, who's had a really good, great season for Bayern Munich. And I thought that was a strange
choice.
She's
been amazing. Such a good player on the counter-attack for Munich. Yeah, she was killing Rosenberg the other day.
Yeah, but again, it's so hard to tell. And I wonder if even, you know, when we get to the second round of international matches, maybe we'll see stuff a bit clearer, because these games are so hard when people are just trying stuff out.
All right, let's hop over that little Atlantic. Come join me, Jesse and Flo. And before we get into the games, four games, and what are four games? I mean, talk about visibility and accessibility. It feels like this was a bit of a gauntlet being thrown down by the NWSL to say, hey, we know you've enjoyed that thing over there called the WSL. We know you stole some of our players, but we are back and we are loud and we are a hot mess and we're full of great goals and skills and exciting young players. Come and turn the lights
but
on.
You know what was a proper hot mess? Fact that it started in an international...
Where do we start?
Fact that it started international window is the messiest thing. So half of the league's best players were on international duty. And this, from an international viewer point of view, some of the kickoffs, could have been a little bit more time friendly.
I mean, have you ever tried to watch Man United Spurs at 4:30 in the morning in San Francisco?
Nope, and I wouldn't like to try.
before we're jumping the gun, before we get into the games, we're going to have a little segment. Thank you so much to Rachel on Twitter, who made sure this got into the show. Let's take you to new podcast, premiering right now, Relatively Fashion.
Take it to the runway.
All right, get your best looks going. Everybody get moving. Voting. Top five kits, 5-1. Who are you backing?
So, I've got mine written down, did some notes. So, coming in hot, number five, is the Louisville... Is that the...
Louis Vuitton?
No, Louisville.
Sorry, Racing Louis Vuitton?
Racing Louis Vuitton. Fleur de Lisha. Is that the home or away? The dark one with...
That's their
away shirt, I think, isn't it?
No,
is
that their home shirt? No,
that's the home one.
You know, you mean the one with the lilies on?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So number five is Louisville home shirt with the flowers and the lilies on. Number four, Orlando Pride Space Race Ad Astra shirt.
Ooh, that's an upset.
Sorry, that's coming in number
four. That would have been higher.
Number three, beating the Pride in the space race, is Houston Dash Space away jersey.
Whoa!
The white one. Number two.
Tell me more on that, because that is not what the consensus public is saying.
Oh, really? Okay, well, you can tell me what the public is saying once I finish mine.
Well, I want to know what Flo Lloyd Hughes is saying.
I just really like it. I don't know what else do you want from me. Number two, Louisville away shirt, that white one with kind of little purple polka dots. I'm a sucker for a polka dot shirt. That French kit gets me every time.
The little fleur-de-lis, by the way.
Oh, I thought the Louisville home was fleur-de-lis, like the sort of flowers.
No,
the
those
Hawaiian
are lilies.
Shirt.
Oh. It's a Hawaii. It's lily flowers and then fleur-de-lis.
Even though I did worked in a garden centre, do not know that much about plants.
Cannot identify a lily to save her life.
Number one has got to be Gotham FC Colossal kit.
Absolutely.
Dark blue with
totally
the light
agree.
Blue sash. Unbelievable. Sign me up.
Sucker for a sash, and especially in that colour. And you know what? It's a great reminder that sometimes a sponsor can make a kit as well. I have no idea what Avaya or whatever that company is, but the way their
font
looks...
But I'm buying
looks,
it, whatever it is.
But I'm
buying
but I'm giving you all my money. But the way the font looks on that kit looks fantastic. Jesse, Relatively Fashion, what's your runway move?
All right, I'm starting off number five with the Dash away kit, which I did really like, apart from the fact that it says "Love Your Dash" on the bottom.
It's a long story, but
I don't like that.
For
that
another takes, podcast.
That's dropped it down to five for me. Number four, I've actually gone for the Orlando Pride new home shirt, like the black to purple. I feel like it's got less attention because of...
That's not true. It's got so much attention.
Isn't that the same one as the one I said, the Ad Astra one?
Yeah, it's the one they shot in space.
I thought that was like the... What's the other one? The moon one.
There's the moon one, which is the goalkeeper shirt, kit. Which is Ashley Marish's moon shirt.
I meant I feel like the moon shirt had got more attention than the Pride home shirt, but maybe not. Maybe that's just my perception.
Fake news.
Feeds are feeds. It's hard. Yeah. It's hard for us all to have the same feeds.
Maybe you just follow loads of Ashlyn Harris stands and you didn't realise.
Maybe. I don't think so, but perhaps. Number three, one that I feel like has been forgotten because it was announced before, but I feel like it's just classic and probably reveals kind of the teams that I like in America, is the Dash home shirt, because I just love the orange. And
classic
I think
orange.
I'm going to say I love the Dash love on this pod. It's been a tough weekend for the Dash, but it's nice to hear their kits getting a shout out. I like the kits. I think there are better shirts out there, but they are good. So it's nice. It's nice to hear him getting a mention.
Okay, well, I'm giving the orange number three. My two and one are the same as Flo's. Number two, the Louisville way. I think that's gorgeous. And number one, that Gotham kit. Loving it.
Wow. Sync up. See, you are family, Jesse. We always knew it. We always knew it. Yeah, I think if I was going to be going on any runway, as I said, I would be in the Gotham FC Colossal home kit. I feel, you know, we don't want to talk too much about other things. We'll save it for the Relatively Capitalism podcast. But I do think there has to be some sort of ultimatum on how much one can morally charge for a football shirt. I don't want to go too deep.
Yeah, but what I will say is I will applaud NWSL teams because they don't release new kits that often. So unlike in England, Orlando Pride have already said they're keeping that Ad Astra shirt till 2022.
Yeah, and I almost put in the Thorns shirt, the black one from with the flowers that they've kept from last year. So I really like that
one. You're
that
right,
is a good thing, because in England and most clubs in Europe, it's just constant new shirts all the time, and it is a bit ridiculous. Whereas I always find with the NWSL teams, they never really change that much. So you
Arsenal
can get away with... Getting,
seven kits a year.
Yeah.
Arsenal
release like seven kits a year.
They do like a special edition, that print one that they did with Adidas.
Training
and they've got
one,
you know, all these different ones. It's ridiculous. So I do appreciate they've done that. And also I do think Gotham FC Colossal kit gets extra points, or in general Gotham FC get extra points, because they've done genderless sizing, which I think is long overdue. Not having bloody like women's Boobs McGee fit as the choice. Just like, do you want it a bit fitted? Do you want it not fitted? Simple as.
Yes.
So extra bonus points for that.
Gotham FC, I loved you before when it was Freya and Elise and Sky Blue, and I love you even more now. Obviously, love your Dash, as Jesse said, but Gotham FC is the number one for me. And I feel like I said before, I mean, this is a great time to get into the NWSL, listener, if you've never watched it. And if I always was said, you know, we've been doing this podcast for 6 months, I always said Sky Blue were such a fun team, you kind of get in early, get in before they're everyone's favorite team. And this Gotham FC rebrand has come at the perfect time, because now you can look really bloody cool and run down that one way and work it and score lots of goals.
Can you tell me why the Dash Space Race shirt isn't getting love?
I think because the Dash got screwed over because Orlando had such a good kit release.
Yeah. And they
sent a shirt into space.
It must have been so gutting to be working on
that.
It
must have been gutting.
And
that's
you have
the thing.
No
I
idea as well what was happening. That is gutting.
No. And the Orlando one was just so good. The press shots, the kit in space, the rollout, the little moon, like, patch sewn thing or whatever. Anyway, can't talk about kits today. We'd love to. We're closing the Relatively Fashion
segment.
Segment of the show. We'll maybe jump it back into there at one point. Let us know what kits you like, listener. I feel like maybe we're all in quite similar boats. But yeah, great kits. Also, great unique designs. The Louisville kit, Orlando, the Dash, they all got their like unique designs from Nike, and that deserves a lot of credit. You know, no more, what you call them, templates?
Yeah.
Or whatever. Yeah, great not to see. Anyway, on the pitch, Houston Dash opened up the whole thing, the whole shebang. Challenge Cup is back. Pro soccer in America is back at every single level. They opened it up. They got a new banner, fireworks. First time being back with lots of fans since the Challenge Cup. Not a great game. Real damp squib this one. Finished 0-0 against last year's runners-up in the Challenge Cup, Chicago Red Stars. Then the lights went down, nighttime came, and Portland Thorns and Kansas City, who are back for the first time in a few years after Utah moved over there, played an absolutely bonkers, very, very fun game, finishing 2-1 with three red cards, four including Mark Parsons being sent off. Then arguably the game of the weekend on Saturday morning, kind of afternoon, evening, your time, I guess.
North Prime Carolina time, Paris. Great kickoff time. Thank you for the scheduling. Enjoyed it.
We'll get. I want to hear about the Twitch broadcast in a sec. North Carolina Courage 3, Washington Spirit 2, and then Racing Louisville entered the NWSL the first time, kicking off at home in front of 5,000 fans at the Lynn Family Stadium, drawing 2-2 with Orlando Pride. Two goals after the 88th minute. Pride thought they'd stolen it, and then Brooke Hendricks scoring an amazingly dramatic goal with rave lights. I don't know if you saw
it.
This.
It was so good.
I loved it.
It's one of those things which if it happened in England, I would roll my eyes and say, the game's gone. But if it happens in America, I'm like, more
Wolves do it quite a lot. They do it like before games. Though,
yeah,
they do a big light
clubs.
Show.
There's a couple of clubs that do a bit more of a light show pre-game. But I think United
But you know what was so
well?
Good about the Louisville thing? So it was like really bad weather. It was raining. It was sunset. And then it was night. And so it's funny because they did it on the first goal, but you didn't really notice it as much because the sun was still up. But for the second goal, the sun had gone down. So when they cut the lights before they hit the purple, it was so dark. Like the whole stadium was blacked out. And so when that purple hits and the light, I mean, Ashna Gugliani, who is a great follow, tweeted hashtag NWSL after dark rave. And I was like, yes.
Well, also, I think it's great for a new team to kind of create something that's their own because it's really going to draw fans in and make. And so many journos were like, can't wait to get to a game down there. That's one of the places I'm most excited about going. And the stadium looks really nice. Looks like a proper purpose-built football stadium rather than teams are often chucked in kind of like random, like multi-purpose venues or huge big bowls, and it just looks
we're looking
like,
at you OL Ray.
So yeah, it just looks like a really fun place, and I for one will be putting it on my bucket list. We actually had a listener question that I wanted to throw in. Hannah, the amazing Leicester City women's fan who lives in Canada.
Hannah, congratulations, by the way.
She's still drunk from promotion. She wanted to ask on our thoughts on the refereeing we've seen so far in the NWSL. I did actually, just before we came on air, see a tweet of Ali Riley's. She's put a picture up of her knee following a challenge on her last night, which the ref basically said was fine. And her knee looks pretty bashed up. So I think the players, after the weekend and that big kind of brawl in that Thorns game, I think the players are getting a little bit tired of the refereeing standards.
So, Hannah, when you say so far, you mean the last 9 seasons of the NWSL.
Yeah.
Obviously, the refereeing is, you know, I think we're going over familiar ground with obviously the league back in England. Like, it's not good, and it hasn't been good. This isn't a new thing. And Danielle Chesky, who is in charge of the Portland-Kansas City game, has previous. I cannot tell you, if you're looking for chaos and hopefully no injuries, obviously player safety is so important. But if you're looking for a game with red cards, a lack of control and fouls, go watch a game that Danielle Chesky referees. It happens every time. Utah versus Houston Dash in the Challenge Cup last year got really out of hand, and it was exactly the same thing. Chesky completely lost control of the game. Didn't know how to talk to the players, didn't know how to set the standards and consistency. And this is kind of what you end up with. I was obviously in Houston at the game. And I do think what hasn't helped, not to like bail the referees out, but this has been the longest preseason ever. These teams have been training with each other for 10 weeks. And I honestly think part of what happened in this crazy weekend of fouls, players were just hyped up and they're ready to go and they've been dying to compete.
Angst.
And I think you just saw, yeah, a little bit. And obviously like there's a line you don't want to cross in regards to player safety. But I do think a lot of it was just these players were really fired up. I mean, Shea Groom didn't get booked. But anyone who watched that Houston Dash game, Shea Groom was just throwing herself around, taking people out. I mean, sometimes she was actually getting fouled, but like as she was getting fouled, she'd bring the player down with her and then complain to the ref. It was really chaos. And I was watching the Dash Chicago game in the press box. Like all of us were like, how are we going to not see a yellow card in the first 2 minutes?
Well, it's up to the referee. Yeah, the referee needs to take control, and they're failing to do that.
To answer Hannah's question, it's not good, but I don't think it's anything new. Were there any other questions, Flo, on the NWSL?
That was all I've seen so far, unless they come in post-recording.
I think there's a couple on the W League, but no spoilers. Jesse, what did you take away from the big Challenge Cup, brilliant Challenge Cup opening?
Yeah, well, the only game that I watched all of was North Carolina against Washington Spirit, mainly because, as Flo said, the times over here are really tricky. And also, I think that game was like, so it was like an 8:30 kickoff here, but that was like the only reasonable kickoff for this whole stretch of game. So it feels hard to like get invested in it.
Can I just interject? So much love to Soph Lawson, who I think was watching these games at ungodly hours.
She doesn't sleep.
Yeah, always a good follow. Been on the pod, part of the family. Go check out Soph Lawson. Jesse, please continue.
But yeah, I mean, obviously the standout kind of from that game was Trinity Rodman, who just looked absolutely amazing. I mean, the goal is obviously the thing that's been shared, and the goal is fantastic, but I just thought even beyond that, her confidence on the ball, her game intelligence, her movement from a player that young was just like unreal. Like it was a different team when she was on the pitch, you know, because of all of the stuff she was creating on the ball, off the ball, and it's a really, really exciting player.
I love how she won that foul as well. There was a foul in the second half. She won a free kick, and the way she used her body dribble into the space, and then she like curved her shoulder. So the only way the person was going to actually get an angle at the ball was to kind of go through it. And then so she doesn't initiate contact, but she sort of shows her body so that the other player plows through her, wins the foul. It was about 20 yards out. I don't think anything happened from it. But then the minute the ref blows whistle, Trinity Rodman just grabbed the ball, put it on the spot, and it was just so professional, so precise. And like you said, very intelligent player. The body awareness was really
And I
good.
think what's mad is that kind of performance would have been like out of this world for someone coming out of the college system. But to look that clever in this at this level, having only played high school football, is just like bonkers to me. Like, I don't even want to think about how good she's going to get.
If we were going to talk winners and losers of the first weekend of the NWSL, one of the biggest losers would be the NCAA, because I think Trinity Rodman is going to shake up these notions. I mean, players like Ashley Sanchez, who actually plays for the Spirit as well, didn't see out her time at UCLA. Mal Pugh is a very well-documented player that, you know, chose to skip college. But I think if we see someone like Trinity Rodman be so capable at her age, then I think maybe we'll see more of this.
I mean, Theo, do you want to talk about, from a Dash point of view, what went down at the Dash game in the stands and how that's been handled?
Yeah, well, I guess this is, yeah, obviously really important to talk about. This is the stuff we have to talk about. We obviously don't like talking about it. If you don't know, basically on Saturday morning, Sarah Gordon for the Chicago Red Stars shared a tweet about her experience, which has been corroborated by Chicago assistant coach, about her boyfriend trying to come down and say hi to her after the game, and a security guard racially profiling him and Sarah, and basically not allowing that interaction to take place, and even threatening to arrest him. Even though, and I can say this from what I saw in the stadium, I'm not trying to throw anyone under the bus, but Bree Vasali was definitely hanging out with some friends or family. You know, you have to believe what Sarah and her boyfriend went through, and it was undoubtedly racially targeted and completely unacceptable in any kind of space that we want to think is safe and inclusive and equal. Obviously, this blows up on Twitter, and the Dash make a statement. No, I mean, the statement is bad in a lot of ways, but I think the first thing you'd want them to see is to support
Or
Sarah,
just
her
acknowledge it
boyfriend,
as well.
acknowledge it. Well, they didn't even say a name. Say, hey, this sucks, this happened to you. We believe you. This is racist. Like, I think like putting a label on it is so important. There's a lot of previous for this with clubs like the Dash and other clubs. Obviously, like, we live in a racist world, so racism is going to happen in stadiums. It's going to happen with security guards. Like, the whole policing system is a racist institution. But I think what's so disappointing is to not see the accountability and the admittance of fault. Because regardless of whatever, I mean, they basically, if you haven't seen the statement, listener, they basically just said, we have these COVID rules in place and the security guard was just trying to enforce them, and we apologize if like it came across the wrong way. But obviously, and they kind of threw their own white players or other Houston Dash players under the bus, and were basically like, well, they shouldn't have been saying hi to their family either. And I think that's kind of besides the
Yeah,
point,
exactly.
because
It's
if
irrelevant
you,
in this context. Like, that's a whole separate statement to bring out, and that's a whole separate discussion to have with your squad. That's besides the point in this kind of thing. And it was just so it was deflecting, wasn't it? And I mean, those of us, like, a lot, I believe most of our listeners will be quite understanding of this situation, but obviously it's worrying how the power brokers in football stateside and football here, you know, I know this from experience and from what happens on this side of the pond, you know, those gatekeepers still don't understand or deliberately ignore or fail to acknowledge these issues. That's what's so frustrating.
Yeah, and I think it goes back to people being upset that Casey Short was used in the CBS documentary, her experiencing her pain and tears and trauma on TV being held by Julie Ertz, because the NWSL is trying to cash in on being a good listener, on taking the steps, you know, being a part of the Black Lives Matter movement, wearing the t-shirts, having the slogans, you know, this word that gets like used a lot. We're having a conversation, we're having conversations, we're doing things. But if Sarah Gordon and her boyfriend don't feel safe in a stadium, if that's all their takeaway from playing their, doing their job, playing their sport, wanting to enjoy the game, just being safe in a stadium, feeling good, then what's the point? You know what I mean? What's the point of doing all the slogans? What's the point of saying you have the conversation if, you know, these people are still being targeted, are being made to feel unsafe? You just want to see more admittance of bad processes, and then the next step is to fix those processes. But if you're saying this was just a COVID check gone wrong, I think you're not really listening. Yeah. So,
yeah.
Jesse, do you have anything on that?
Yeah, I mean, just really to echo what both of you have said, I think it is that gap, isn't it, really, between the kind of PR sheen that has to come out on any statement like this, which just ultimately obfuscates any real or satisfying action to be taken. And it's just a classic thing where the image of the brand seems to always come ahead of any kind of serious consideration of the hurt and offence that has genuinely been caused, because it just feels like the brand takes precedence, and the you know, the stories that are told become an affront to the brand as a whole, and that is what has to be protected at all costs. And it's just really depressing, isn't it, at the end of the day?
Yeah. Well said. And yeah, like I said, thoughts go out to Sarah Gordon. She just wants to feel safe in a stadium, play her game, not have to worry about being racially profiled. Okay, moving on from all that tough stuff, we are going to Australia, who finished up with a fabulous W League final between Sydney and Melbourne Victory, which finished 1-0 to Melbourne. After 120 minutes of football, there was nothing between them. But then from a corner, Kyra Cooney cross by name, cross by nature, scoring directly from a corner, known as an Olympico. Thank you, Ashna Guglielmi, once again for reminding us, scored the winner. Melbourne had 30 shots throughout the game, which really was quite maddening to see. Sydney were the number one seed, finishing top of the table during the regular season. And actually, they had beaten Melbourne 2 weeks earlier, the last game in the regular season, beating Melbourne 2-1. So this must have been really annoying for Sydney, who sometimes when you've already beaten a team, you've almost got that mental block of you might underestimate them. Kyra Cooney Cross also scored in that previous game, so Sydney must be kind of haunted by her and her fabulous goals. I'm going to open up with a few listener questions on this, and then Jesse and Flo jump into anything you found interesting about the game. Ashna said, is there a better way to win a final than an 120-minute Olympico? And Craig Hadley, wonderful Craig, said, does the W League need to increase the number of matches and or teams? And Flo, I think you might have had one more question as well.
Yeah, I had a really fun DM actually from a guy that follows me called Andy Kovach, which I think is such a great name. It's like a detective's name on a crime show.
Shout out, Andy.
Anyway,
if you're solving any crime, let us know.
He's messaged me about other football stuff. I think he messaged me about Aussie football in general. He's a big Matildas fan. Anyway, he asked me today if I'd watched the W League final, and he asked me, out of the players on the pitch today, who do we think could be playing in the WSL? Obviously, WSL's got quite a few Aussies already. There's been a bit of an Aussie invasion. But I do think the match winner could probably shake things up. I think she is a star for the future for Australia, Cooney Cross. And on the commentary as well, like, I didn't know much about her, but they were constantly talking about her in the commentary, which gives you a sense of how she's kind of regarded in Australia. And she was very impressive. She was great on the ball. She had a great touch, really technical player. And also Vyman, the goalie, who had put in a storming performance for Sydney and kind of kept them in the game. She was incredible, and it was just so heart-wrenching to see her fall in the last minute and not be able to deal with that corner that came in. So that was a little bit sad, but I mean, she seems like a really impressive goalkeeping talent. So they were the two standouts for me in terms of the next gen Matildas that might be coming over and playing in the WSL.
Jesse, do you think there's a better way to win a final than 120-minute Olympico?
I was just going to say, scoring from a corner has to be one of my most favourite kind of goals anyway. To score from a corner in extra time and to win a championship, that is top notch, in my opinion. I was kind of surprised, actually, that I wondered if in another league whether you'd have seen that blown for the pressure on the goalie.
Ooh.
That was the only thing that surprised me
not
about it.
Yourself.
Like, I didn't... not in the NWSL, but maybe in, like, at least the Premier League, it's a bit of a trope, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah,
like,
I think
in the Premier League, you can't touch the goalie, but...
In the EFL as well, I think. Well, certainly in the Championship, I think you'd probably... There is quite a lot of protection for goalies.
Men are very delicate, though, so it kind of checks out.
That is true. but yeah, I thought it was very satisfying. I mean, for what it's worth, I don't think there was a foul on the goalie. It just surprised me because I feel like you don't see goalies crowded in that way in English football so much.
And what was really interesting is they just had a corner just before that they managed to deal with, and then there was basically time just for one more corner, and then there was a little bit of added time added on, but it was kind of essentially at one point could have been the last kick of the game, and then the celebrations obviously ended up with a bit more out of time. But there was something that felt weird when they got that second corner, like, uh-oh, they've got another chance. And they'd come so close. Bit of a throwback person, Lisa Devano, who's got loads of caps for Australia. She's 36 now. She had so many match-winning opportunities that you're like, how is a player of her ability not finishing these? That you almost felt like, they're going to get one more shot. They're going to get another chance to do this. And then it had to be, like, you know, the teenage sensation star of the show, Cooney Cross, who I think is going to be a massive player for Australia, judging by the, like, judging by the write-ups of her as well, getting that match winner. It's this whole kind of, like, oh, coming of age story of this player. So I think that's really exciting. To answer Craig's question,
yeah,
I think Australian women's football is in a bit of a weird time, because obviously they've got the World Cup, which is huge, and that inevitably leads to better development, better investment, because they want to do well. But I also think they're in a bit of a weird position because other domestic leagues are progressing at such a rate, and I feel like they almost can't keep up. And I think that's going to be the struggle, is because their men's domestic league isn't that strong either, it hasn't necessarily got the investment to pull up. And the FFA does a lot of the work on trying to keep those two, like, keep professional Australian men's football afloat as well, because it's not the main sport in Australia. You know, Aussie rules, cricket, rugby is a bigger deal than football there. So it's always sort of battling against that. And I think that, you know, will hampen the W League's prospects as well, because women's AFL, women's Aussie rules is absolutely exploding on Australia. Women's cricket is absolutely exploding in there. Netball is huge there. Women's football, although we've got these huge names like Sam Kerr and Hayley Rasso and all these players that Caitlin Ford that we know over here, it's not that big yet over there. So it'll be interesting to see what the impact has with the World Cup going there and how that might push the W League and push women's football in general.
Yeah, also, Theo, I wanted to ask, because I know the NWSL has kind of, like, shifted its season, right? And in the past, we've seen players kind of move between the NWSL and Australia, and that's kind of what's made the, you know, given the W League a real boost, in that you've had the big name Australia players come back and a number of, like, Americans go there as well. Like, what impact do you think that's going to have on the Australian league.
Well, also the WSL stole all those players that would potentially be doubling up with seasons, right, as well.
That's I think it's a funny mix of COVID, WSL investment, and NWSL investment has squeezed out the W League. I mean, even players like Jess Fishlock actually had really successful careers going multiple times to Melbourne. I think Jess Fishlock might have even done some coaching out there as well.
She managed Melbourne City, so the championship. Yeah. She took over when Joe Montenegro left.
Exactly. So there's a lot of, and obviously she's been in Seattle for 7 seasons, 8 seasons or something. I think it worked. And so obviously with trades like Lavelle, Dal Campa, Press and Heath.
I always do that.
And Mewis, you've seen the WSL jump in there. Hayley Rasso, Caitlin Ford, obviously went from the NWSL into the WSL, and Sam Kerr, because now she's playing for Chelsea, used to go and play there as well when she was in Chicago. So yeah, it's been a part of the kind of WOSO economy, geographic economy, is the W League being that little filler at the beginning of the year. I don't know. I feel, like I said, I think it's a combination of COVID and the
is the Challenge Cup gonna be a thing every year now? Because if it is, then you can't do the W League, really. Because
do you think it's also an impact on wages? Because I feel like before it's like a get paid all year round kind of vibe. Whereas now, if you're getting paid a reasonable salary that you can live on all year round, you don't have what is your impetus to like fill your off season with games, basically?
Anyway, here we are. A lot of football talked about. A lot of good times had, some bad times had, some fashion, some football. And yeah, what an honor to have Jesse Parker Humphreys on the show. Jesse, I listen to you in my ears quite a lot, as I'm sure you are probably fed up of hearing Flo and I. So where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at JesseJPH, and you can find my writing and podcasting shared there.
Any shout outs for those writings and podcasting? We're going to leave it nice and mysterious.
I'll leave it nice and mysterious. You know, you never know where I might pop up and what I might be saying. That's why you got to follow.
Yeah, I like that. It's a teaser. I mean, like I said, listen, go and listen to Jesse and lots of other great writers that Jesse is associated with. There's lots of good stuff out there. Well, I'm going to let everyone get back to their Sunday evening. Thanks so much for hanging out and being part of the family, Jesse. Flo, what are you off to do?
I'm going to watch Line of Duty. Let's bloody do this.
Plug.
Let's find some
You're just here to plug Line of Duty. You, Jesse?
Pretty much.
I'm going to watch Line of Duty too.
Bloody hell. Well, I will not be watching Line of Duty, listener. I'm going to get off to my afternoon and see how it goes. Be well, stay safe, wear a mask, and try and show some love in the world. All right. See you later.